each position from Mr. Lorry, reel two.
The coxswain would normally be steering from the wheelhouse, but during the action, or period running up to the action, he was steering from the bridge position, and one of his duties would have been working the engine room telegraphs. So I was given that job to do. I was also had my eye on the echo sounding equipment because we were travelling over a rather shallow part of the river, and although there was quite a lot of room, quite a lot of depth for a boat of our size, the Cameltown, in fact, was almost scraping on the seabed going up the river. But at any rate, we had to, or I had to, during my run in there, carry on a conversation with the captain on the bridge. Saying all quiet on the air, 9 feet of water showing up, 200 revs, and so on. Then, of course, I was aware that, although I couldn't see anything at all in there, I was aware that, of course, things were hotting up. I could hear the noise of the guns firing, because once we'd been observed by the Germans and identified as enemy to them, then of course action started. We hauled down our swastikas, hauled up our white ensigns, and from there on it was into battle. But for my own part, I couldn't, of course, see what was going on, just hear it. And then I was quite aware a short time after that we'd been hit. It's like, of course, well, if you're driving a motor car and something hits you with a wallop, it's a similar feeling to that, of course. You're rocked about quite a bit. But apart from that, of course, I could see that suddenly the rev counters, etc., on the boat were weren't showing as it should. So I was shouting in as loud a voice as I could that the engines had stopped, and I could hear the captain's voice literally screaming above all this noise, to giving orders to various people and to me. And I think he passed some remark like, "Well, I know they have," when I said that the engines had stopped. But what had happened, of course, a shell had hit this motor launch. These motor launches were made of wood, very good boats, very well constructed, very good sea boats. They could stand extremely rough weather. But of course, same token, although they were quite strongly built, they were also, of course, easily set on fire. And one shell had hit the engine room combing, the roof as it were of the engine room, and we had about 14 or 15 commandos crouched on the decks waiting to spring ashore, and I think we lost about 9 of them. Well, a few managed to jump ashore because our object was to land these commandos alongside the old mole, this projecting pier in the river. And in fact, a couple of them, or perhaps I believe about 5, got ashore. One was killed as he jumped. I'd been talking to him just a few hours earlier. He'd been in my wireless office, and I can remember him quite plainly. But along with the soldiers who were killed, we lost 3 or 4 members of our crew. Where our crew was about, I think we had about 15. We had a few extra officers and ratings for this particular operation. But of course, it set on fire. The extra fuel tanks I mentioned earlier carried several hundred gallons of petrol, so you can imagine what happened when I got to them. But the only thing we could do was to abandon ship. Those were so left, and so I managed to get out of the wheelhouse after freeing the door, which had jammed. But I managed to destroy some of the equipment before I left. Some of the echo sounding equipment and radio equipment. But the next thing was to get overboard into the water, and I met a soldier who was preparing to leave, and he said he couldn't swim. However, I helped him get overboard, down a rope actually over the forecastle into the water, and it was just like going to a cold bath, of course, 2 o'clock on a March morning. And but we weren't so concerned about the temperature of the water, but by the heat, as it were, of the action taking place. So, trace of bullets everywhere, guns booming, shouting all over the place, and a real, really pandemonium, I suppose. Because the commanders had landed at various points, they were doing quite a lot of demolition work in the dockyards, in the area. For example, a lot of demolition work was done on the pump house, the equipment used for this large dock. Our motor torpedo boat also had torpedoed the gates of the submarine basin. These German submarines, U-boats, and they could only get out to sea on certain tides. I'm wrong putting it that way. They could go out at any time because of the lock gates which were there. Once this MTB and fired its torpedo and burst the gates, then the basin became tidal and they could only use it at certain times of the day. So of course that provided quite a handicap for the Germans in operating their U-boats. The dock itself, the Campbelltown, blew up several hours later. The Germans claimed at the time, in the first broadcast, that in fact it didn't do any damage at all. But it blew up with, I believe, several hundred Germans on board.
Did you see this yourself?
No. This is just what we were told later, that it all came out later. The Germans, in fact, admitted quite a lot. They lost a large number of people coming aboard sightseeing, as it were. Come to see, look what we've got, the German British destroyer which has come in here, and a gift to us. In fact, it blew up, and very many lives were lost. The commanders themselves, they weren't able to carry out all their objectives because many of them were killed or badly wounded. However, I think the majority of the objectives were carried out. Certainly the two main ones were the blowing up of the dock gates and the torpedoing of the tidal basin. I just managed to get ashore. Even after just a short swim, it's quite exhausting, especially at that time of the morning, wearing a life belt and a steel helmet, etc. we just ran into some Germans. My first reaction was to hide behind some large reels of barbed wire. You can imagine how effective that would have been. Because of course, any of us who had arms would find them quite useless after being in the water at the time. I personally wasn't armed in my particular job. But we ran into these Germans, and the next few minutes we were spent doubling through the streets with these fellows firing revolvers in the air, and I felt as if I was in the sitting in a cinema watching myself in a cowboy film.
You were being chased through the streets?
We were being taken through the streets by these Germans, you see, to a quiet spot, in fact the courtyard of a large house. We came to a crossroads, and one of these Germans would say this way, another one that way, and they shepherded us anyhow into the courtyard of a house. And I joined my CO, and as I came ashore, and there must have been about a dozen of us in this courtyard. The Germans started, first of all they took our life jackets and steel helmets away. It was a moonlight night, of course there was and searchlights and tracer bullets flying around, and the next thing we knew they were fumbling with ammunition boxes, so it appeared to be ammunition boxes, and fixing bayonets on their rifles. And I must say that was rather an uneasy few moments, because we thought that they were going to bayonet us. In fact, I think that they were just as nervous of the situation as we probably were, and just taking precautions. We were then hustled away again to what turned out to be sort of a lay apart or store for the U-boats. In other words, a store full of engine parts and so on, adjacent to one of these U-boat pens. And as we were taken through the door, I think the first remark we heard from this German colonel, or whatever rank he was, you know, for you the war is over. You know, as much to say, no need to worry now. It's all over for you. But that, of course, was just the beginning.
So what happened to you next?
We were this must mean something, somewhere around 2 or 3 in the morning, and by about 8 in the morning, 8 or 9, of course, the town was fairly quiet. The action was over. the Campbelltown, that was when, whilst I was in this shelter, we heard what appeared to be a large thudding noise. In fact, that was when the Campbelltown had blown up. We were then taken to a house where we were able to dry our clothes to some extent by taking off piece by piece and hanging it on a fence and waiting for it to dry. And we were taken in individually or in pairs into this house to be interrogated by a German army officer.
And just one person was interrogating, was it?
Well, there was the one in his traditional long cloak, rimless glasses, and the type who usually appears in the in the film showing the typical German officer of those days interrogating. No, he had an interpreter with him. The interpreter speak very good English. The interrogating officer, in fact, speaks some English, but not a lot. Of course, we were asked all sorts of questions, to which we gave all sorts of answers. The sillier the better. I think they don't know what they made out of it. Of course, we technically you're not obliged to give more than your name, rank, and official number. And as far as possible, you stick to that. But it's very, very easy to be led into saying something. The most innocent remark by an interrogator, you know, can you find yourself in a trap, and you have to wriggle out of it if you can. But in fact, the secrecy of the whole affair had been so well kept that very few of us would have known little that would have been of value to the enemy. But this was followed somewhat later by another interrogation after I'd reached the prison of war camp in Germany. But and that was a more thorough affair. But this first interrogation, the one of the questions asked was about what did we think of Winston Churchill? You see, of course, we obviously said, you know, what a good person, what a good leader he was, and there was some sarcastic comment about, oh, funny, you know, I wouldn't have thought that he was all that great and so on. But this officer did then ask me what we in Britain thought about the fall of Singapore. Couldn't have asked more awkward sort of questions, rather a touchy thing at that time to all of us. But he in fact had been, before the war, a personal friend of our Commander-in-Chief at Singapore at the time when it fell, as Air Vice Marshal, who was in charge. But well, I didn't know what the reaction was. I wasn't going to say in any case.
So, did they ask you any questions about the actual raid itself?
Yes, they were obviously very concerned and very much unaware of our object in coming over there. They knew, of course, once the ship had blown up, just what damage was caused to this dock. It was put out of action to the extent that it didn't come into use for several years after the war. But I think that they were taken entirely unawares. The Air Force, the Royal Air Force, was supposed to carry out a sort of softening up bombing raid before the operation started. That might have, in fact, put them more on the alert. Something went wrong in the timing, I think, and also the weather conditions, so that the RAF weren't able to do this particular part of the operation. But in a way, it was perhaps a good thing in that it didn't alert the Germans, and it wasn't. In fact, we tried to bluff our way up the estuary. Signals were exchanged with the German shore batteries by the signalman on the bridge of the Campbelltown, saying the fact that we were this German anti-submarine force, that we were coming in with so many casualties, requesting ambulance assistance and so on. And it worked for a minute or two, until the Germans, of course, then realised that this was all false, and they realised that in fact it was not a German force at all coming into the river.
How long did the interrogation last for?
Oh, difficult to say, probably 10 minutes, something like that. Not very long, and I hope that I didn't give anything away at all. They asked us questions, as you know, where did you leave from in England, and so on. They got all sorts of answers, if they got any at all, different people, and they of course tried to piece it all together to make up some sort of feasible story. But I'm sure that they were caught unawares, and I'm also sure that they wouldn't get a lot of information from our chaps.
What happened after the interrogation?
We were then taken to put into army lorries and taken to a camp near the town of Rennes. This camp was used to house French colonial troops been captured in North Africa. We were in there for 2 or 3 days, and this is where we were first registered as prisoners of war, given a metal disc with a number. I've still got mine there. And at this point, Colonel Newman, who was in charge of the military side of the operation, Commander Ryder being in charge of the naval side, Colonel Newman stood by each of us as we registered as prisoners of war. In other words, just the details of our name, rank and official number, and he stood there smoking his pipe as he always did, and making very sure that no one gave anything other than what was required by regulation.
Under what conditions were you being kept at Rennes?
Not very pleasant. We were in kept in large wooden huts with rather flea-ridden mattresses and so on, and it wasn't very comfortable at all, but the worst was yet to come. At least it was not very pleasant to be kept in a building all day, and you know, the unpleasantness of the numbers in such a small area all cooped up. But we were then taken to the railway station to start what turned out to be a 4-day journey in cattle trucks.
Can you describe that?
Well, these trucks, written on the side of each one in French, it said 8 horses or 40 men. And in fact, I believe the van which I was in had something 36 or 37 men. When they were used to transport horses, the horses, I think, had at least the opportunity to look out through the grills on the side, but they were boarded up for us, and we were given rations, food and corned beef. Actually, I think it had been captured possibly at Dunkirk, because, you know, British by corned beef. We were given these rations, told that they were to last for 48 hours. Well, by this time, being a little hungry, we ate it all in 24 hours. The journey, in fact, turned out to last for 96 hours. With only one break, we stopped at Aachen. La Chapelle, I think the old French name. We stopped there. We were given a bowl of soup each. Most welcome, I think that was. But the journey itself was really terrible, because we were cramped into this van. You either had to stand up, or you couldn't possibly lie down. You crouched down as well as you could. The sanitary arrangements were very primitive, to which one large tin resembling a 5-gallon oil drum corner. You can imagine the situation after a day or so, conditions like that.
So did they not give you any more food other than what you've described?
That was all in for the 4 days. We had some this soup, which was was welcome, but that was all until we reached the camp, which was to be our home for the next, well, nearly 3 years.
Which camp was this?
Well, Marlag and Milag, which was the only naval camp in Germany. The Milag side was for the merchant navy. Marlag was in two sections. Marlag O for officers, Marlag M for NCOs, the navy. And this is the part that I spent my time in for the rest of my stay in Germany. If one was below NCO rank, for example, a naval seaman in the navy or private in the army, one was obliged to go out to work, and you'd be sent off to work on farms or elsewhere in Germany. But we didn't have to go out to work. There were a few who did volunteer. It was frowned on by our own people to volunteer, but in some cases it was probably quite reasonable for them to go out to work, I think, from a point of view of from a mental point of view, that there are some people who just can't stand the situation of captivity, and perhaps isn't easy for anyone, but there are some who would break up fairly quickly unless they were able to get out and say work on a farm or do something like that. Most of us who were in there, of course, we then set about occupying our time in different ways, and so that, you know, this situation didn't arise, that we were able to put up with what was to come.
How did you personally keep yourself amused?
Well, this camp, first of all, I spent a few weeks in a camp called San Bostel. This was a type of transit camp, I imagine. Rather interesting in a way. We had people from different nationalities, French, Yugoslavs, and in a compound separate from us were Russian prisoners. And we were there for 2 or 3 days, but all day long in this other compound we could see these Russians who were in many cases stripped to the waist, and they were being medically examined, or at any rate an examination of some sort. A lot of these Russians appear to be Mongolian type soldiers probably, and the Germans were measuring using rulers and other devices, calipers, so measuring the, say, the width of the head, the features, chest measurement, all sorts of things like that, rather than just some sort of biological study going on. But of course we read all sorts of gruesome things into it. We didn't know quite what, but we never found out just why they were doing this at all. Maybe it was a perfectly reasonable thing that the Germans were studying the other races, the non-Aryan types, to see just how, what they could find out.
Did the Germans seem to be treating the POWs of other nationalities in exactly the same way as the British, or were there any differences?
Well, I think over the next couple of years, 3 years, I think we found out in various ways that although we know that many British men, women were treated very roughly different places. For example, friends of mine who were on board HMS Glorious, sunk in the icy waters of the North Sea. A particular friend of mine, a warrant officer who suffered frostbite, so on. He and others were treated pretty badly. This was early on in the war, but generally